We have a whole panel of presenters tonight. We ask each of them to give us about 15 minutes or so of their time and give us their thoughts and ideas about the life, the legacy, and the contributions of Dr. King. And the first that I would like to invite up is one of our hardest fighting freedom fighters, Sister Willa Cofield. Y'all don't know, but Willa Cofield has a long history in the civil rights movement, and she's gonna tell us about it right now. Give Willa a big hand.
Privilege to be asked to speak at POP and to talk about Dr. King and to talk about my own experiences in the civil rights struggle. And I bring with me, don't want to get emotional, but I bring with me as right. I talk the spirits of so many wonderful people who gave so much, who struggled. Some of them gave their lives. Some of them gave their homes, their livelihoods. And it's just so meaningful to me to be able to share with a group of people, to share with you something about this history. Because it is a remarkable history that has been really overlooked. And it's just about unknown. There are only a few of us alive who experienced it, and it has not been documented. So I thank you, Larry, for making me go back through my old folders and papers and to try to put this together. And it's so long, I can't really tell you all tonight, but I can show you something about how the age. I found two papers. And this one, Goodman, Schwerner, and Cheney were still missing when this paper was published. And at the top it says, teacher sues campaign manager. And this person right here is me. That's the way I looked. The person I was suing, well, there was a whole slate of them, but this person is Joseph Branch. And he was the big, big power person in Halifax County. He was also campaign manager of Dan Moore. Dan Moore was the governor. So you see, I was taking on a pretty big piece. And that day, $250,000 is what I was suing him and all of the school board and the school district for. And that was an enormous amount of money, $250,000. The person at the bottom, there's one more, was a school principal, and I worked in that school. The other paper that I found is this one. That says, fiery KKK cross burns near teacher's infield home. So after I filed the suit, it was published in the papers. This was a black paper, but in most of the state papers. And on July 4th, 1964, my neighbor came to my house and said, look at that mess across the street. And right in front of my house was a 17-foot cross that was on fire. So that was just two of three crosses that were burned during that period between 1963 and 65 in our town. And the last one was burned at a woman's house. Her name is Alice Evans, and she's still alive. And when they looked out and saw the cross, her husband got his shotgun. And he shot right in the middle of the people who were trying to put it down. And that was the last cross that was burned. Yeah. tell you just a little bit about the conditions in our town and why before we got started. And I think you can see that we didn't have any choice but to try to change things. In 1964, in our town, in the section that black people lived in, we had no paved streets, we had no sewage, we had open ditches, they were common. We actually had no high school for black students. By 64 we did. But when I went to high school in that town, we had a white high school, but we were bused 3 miles out of town to another school. And the school that blacks attended burned down. And while black students had no school to go to, the town built a beautiful new school for white students, which excluded us. They finally built 6 classrooms near the elementary school, which they called the high school. And that's the school that I taught in. It had no auditorium, no gymnasium. They finally added a few things, but it was just very, very basic. Poverty was pervasive in our town. Black people worked for $3 a day. The median income for black people was $1,400 per year. 60% of the houses were unsound or didn't have plumbing. In the school I taught, many children did not get to school until Christmas because they lived on farms, and the farm owners demanded that they stay home and pick cotton and get the crops in before they could come to school. So many students really did not get there until the 1st of December. We had no black representation in the government at all. The municipal government, the county government were all white. The police force was all white. We had other indignities, like the theater. If you went to the theater and you were a black person, you had to buy a ticket, and then you went on stairs that were outside up to the balcony where you sat. On Saturday night, another indignity, a loud whistle was blown for all black people to get off the streets and to go home. There was no service for blacks at the drugstore. Everything was segregated, doctor's offices. You couldn't even buy an ice cream cone. A friend of mine who was a new teacher in town went to the drugstore and asked for an ice cream cone, and the drugstore owner called the principal to ask, you know, you better talk to that teacher. She doesn't understand. Restaurants did not serve blacks. That goes without saying. The Plantation Grill in our town, if they saw a black person approaching coming to the door, they locked the door. So this was the situation. But my husband, at that time I had a different name, was Johnson. And my husband, whose name was Reed Johnson, demonstrated an act of courage. And it shocked and electrified the town. It scared me to death. He told me, I'm going to run for the town council. And I said, oh, I think that's a good idea, but why don't you do it next year? And he said, you know, no, I'm going to do it this year. And he did. Well, it was widely reported that this was the first time that a Negro had ever run for political office in Enfield. It was in the papers. I said it. Everybody was saying it. It's so interesting to know that many years later, we found that many black people had served in political offices in our town. We knew nothing about it. We found that the first real black congressman had come from Enfield. That before James O'Hara went to Congress, the black people who sat in Congress were more or less ceremonial. They just sat there. They didn't propose legislation. They didn't talk. But when James O'Hara, who was an attorney, went to Congress, he was vocal, he spoke, he sponsored bills, and he was from our town. Now, Enfield had fewer than 3,000 people. So that it's a remarkable thing that a man, he started the paper that may still be published called the Enfield Progress. He had started that paper. But that history had all vanished by the time my husband ran for political office. As I said, this alarmed the community. It's a long, long story. I'm just going to have to try to give you some highlights. But the community was really shocked. And the first cross was burned on our lawn. We looked out our back window one night, and there was this flame going up, and we found it was a cross. Then we received threats on the telephone that, you know, that Reed should get out of this race, or something bad was going to happen to him. But I guess that just stimulated things. And so my husband and another school teacher carried carloads of people down to register. Well, the registrar closed the books so that nobody else could register. And people were so upset, they started thinking about having a sit-in on her porch. And so the books were quietly reopened. He lost the race, but we had started something, and it just took off. My students were very, very interested in the sit-ins, and they were following. They would bring news clippings, and we would put them in the room. And one day, one of my students had actually seen college students sitting in Durham, and he told us about it. Just a couple of days later, 15 students came to me after school and said, "We are going downtown to use the public library," which was closed to blacks. So I said, quite lightly, I said, "Well, maybe you'll get your picture in the paper." The students went, they were denied that, they were told they couldn't come in. They went to the mayor's office. The mayor wasn't there. The mayor also worked in a hardware store as a clerk. But they made an appointment to see him. Soon after that, we took the students to hear Floyd McKissick speak. And Floyd talked about the walls of Jericho and how Joshua was willing to try to breach that wall. When the older people said, "No, you can't knock that down. You can't get over that wall." And it just stimulated them. When we got back, they went down to the theater. This was a night later. They went down to the theater, and they confronted the theater manager and asked him to change his seating arrangement. He said, "Oh, I just do this as a community service. You don't have to come. If you don't like the way the seats are, just don't come." So they came back to my house. We called Floyd McKissick. He said, "Put up a picket line." The next day, we had a picket line. Nobody in this town had ever seen a picket line. So there was a traffic jam. I mean, people were coming from everywhere to see the picket line. 4 weeks later, that theater closed. Well, we had people from CORE, we had the NAAC commandos, we had SCLC. Martin Luther King never really came to our town, but he said Fred Shuttlesworth came, well, C.T. Vivian well, came, mm-hmm. Harry Boyett came. Well. Then King sent his whole staff up to train us in his citizenship school. So Septimus Clark came, yes. Dorothy Cotton, Hosea Williams, all of those SCL people. And we were trained for a week in passive resistance and nonviolent direct action and, you know, how you get a petition together. We were given a political education. Then I took 15 students down to Dr. King's Institute in Georgia at Dorchester Center, and we were there for a week, and it was wonderful. You just can't imagine the spirit. When we walked in, they had, I mean, the rooms were so bare and everything was so downtrodden. The kids were really depressed. But before the week was over, they didn't want to leave. In fact, some of them were in tears when we left. The morale was so high. I can remember that the demonstrations were going on in St. Augustine at Florida, and people came back from that demonstration telling us about what was going on. And it was just heart-wrenching to hear these people tell their stories. There was a lot of singing everywhere. Anytime we would break open into freedom songs. Wow. It was just, morale was so high. The people who were there were from, they were leaders in their community. So we learned what was going on down in Southwest Georgia and in the Mississippi Delta and in the Sea Islands of South Carolina. It was just wonderful. And I guess maybe I'll tell a little bit about the citizenship schools and kind of wind it up. But that was an idea that King had that started well before the 60s. That it was actually started in South Carolina by a man named Esau Jenkins and Bernice Robinson. Oh. That they could teach people to read and write so they could pass the literacy exams, tests that you had to take in order to register, and that they could use political terminology and concepts as they taught these skills. And so people would have some sophistication when they left. Well, that idea was taken to the Highlander Folk School in Tennessee. And September Clark, who was from Charleston, South Carolina, who had been fired because she was a teacher who refused to give up her membership in the NAACP, she was teaching at the Highlander Folk School. She taught Rosa Parks 3 weeks before Rosa Parks went back to Montgomery and refused to give up her seat. So this was a citizenship school. Dorothy Cotton, who was one of the directors of the school, said that the citizenship schools were the whole backbone of the civil rights movement. That wherever people were intensely struggling, they had had training. The leaders had been to the citizenship school. So I ran a class in my community when I got back.
Go ahead.
I had about 10 people. The oldest person I remember was 69, and I thought that was so old. I don't think so anymore. But these people were so grateful. These were poor people who had never had a chance to go to school and to learn how, they had always had to make an X when they were asked to sign any paper. They were so happy. So we went to church and they were awarded their certificates, all signed by Dr. Martin Luther King. Mm. And these people were so happy.
Yes.
So that was the story of the citizenship school. Our movement progressed until, I'd say, 65. And we reached our, I guess, climax in the voter registration drive. We had to go into federal court 4 times to carry out the registration drive. The first time, the registrar slowed down. They would take as long as 40 minutes with one person. Then when the court said, you can't take that much time, then they would only take 3 minutes. So people didn't have time. But we finally got them to give a fair kind of test. So we were able to increase the registration in the community. And we have a slate of black men, all men, who ran for a political office. None of them won, but we registered a lot of people. And in the course of that, I was fired, and we had the big suit. And my case was heard first in the Eastern District Court in North Carolina before Judge Larkins. And I lost that case. Then it was appealed in the Fourth Circuit. And there it was turned around and I won. So Thank you so much for listening to my story. And
you don't know who you be sitting next to, right? And she did it every beat.
She just quiet as she was and taught the Freedom Citizenship Schools and everything. We're so thankful to have Willa Cofield in the People's Organization for Progress.
I just want to recognize some people as we move along. I see Sister Genemisa Barbara King of Africa Newark. Give her a big hand. Wonderful thing with the Africa Newark Festival, and they had a wonderful Kwanzaa. They had the creative Kwanzaa. They had Dr. Malana Karenga. And I will continue to recognize, I see the leader of the peace movement in New Jersey, Madeline Hoffman, is here tonight. Give her a big hand. Hopefully we'll hear from Madeline before the night is over. But right now, you heard how Willa had to struggle to get black representation in office. And I see the city council president of Irvington here, one of our members, John Sowell. Give him a hand. All these cop members are going on now. they mayors and they city councilmen and everything else. But we've been waging a tremendous struggle under the leadership of Kathleen Witch and NAACP to fight to keep Irvington Hospital home. Give her a hand, she's here tonight, Ms. Witcher. We're gonna hear from her. But seldom do you see elected officials engage with such a fervor in protest as we have seen with the mayor of the city of Irvington, who is here with us tonight, been on the front line.
Yeah.
Been on the front line. Mayor Wayne Smith of Irvington, give him a big hand.